You know what I really need right now is an insurance policy to protect me against any stupid investment I might ever make. Is there such a thing? There is.
The credit default swap allows the investor to assume or be exposed only to pure credit risk for the on the risky asset, as opposed to funding risk, market risk, and currency.
Call
risk.
Them incomprehensible. So credit default swaps, once popular, now worthless. There may be $60 trillion on the line out there. The Bush rescue plan could become the bailout to nowhere. If it sounds too good to be true, it's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, John. It's Monday, October 6th. So just so I get this right, if I make a really bad investment and I buy an insurance policy from you, you're going to...
I'm good for $60 trillion. Good morning, Adora.
Okay, that's good to know. Today, we're going to take a look at the White House's financial plan. How will it work as Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson sits down at his desk this morning? Is he going to begin buying? Also, in the election's final weeks, we go to New Hampshire to follow a key Senate race. And science, what does the next president need to know about it? And an argument for why you should be able to do your banking and mail your letters at the post office. Those stories are coming up, but first we have headlines.
It's a hot campaign trail. Over the weekend, Sarah Palin hammered away at Barack Obama's association in the early 90s with fellow Chicagoan Bill Ayers, the founder of the Weather Underground.
According to the New York Times, he was a domestic terrorist and part of a group that, quote, launched a campaign of bombings that would target the Pentagon and the U.S. Capitol.
Meanwhile, in Asheville, North Carolina, Barack Obama called the attack simply a distraction.
So I can understand why Senator McCain would want to turn the page and ignore the economy. But I also know this. You're trying to pay your bills every week and stay above water. You can't ignore the economy.
An issue likely to come up in the next debate tomorrow night in Nashville. John McCain has an event in Albuquerque later today.
The world markets are not reacting well to the passage of the president's $700 billion financial plan. In Asia, Tokyo's Nikkei dropped to its lowest level in more than 4 years, closing down more than 4%. In Europe, markets are down around 6%. And oil prices have fallen below $90 a barrel. That's an eight-month low that comes as fears of the spreading financial crisis will bring a global economic slowdown and therefore cut demand for crude oil.
Also following a trend, German finance ministry is pumping $70 billion into the country's biggest mortgage banks and has agreed to insure all of the deposits in that country. In baseball, the Angels beat the Red Sox 5-4 in extra innings. The White Sox beat Tampa Bay 5-3. The Phillies beat Milwaukee 6-2. Brewers are out. The Dow closed down on Friday and is poised to go lower again this morning. Same with the S&P. Sarah Palin says Barack Obama's palling around with terrorists. Obama supporters are talking about the key Heating 5 and John McCain. Is it a distraction from the real issues? What do you think? Distraction?
I think so.
877-8-MY-TAKE. We care about your opinion much more than ours. Or MyTAKE at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. You might say world markets are looking for confidence in all the wrong places. After the financial bill got passed over the weekend, this morning, European bank shares are tumbling. There have been more banks acquired by other banks this morning. There have been threats of bank failures in Europe. International markets have been reacting to a weekend of deals aimed at shoring up all kinds of banks and financial institutions. Also, there's a sell-off this morning in Asia. We're joined on the line from London by BBC business correspondent Alex Ritson. Alex, thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you, John.
You know, confidence is the name of the game here. Let's just talk generally for one moment before we get into the specific sell-offs and the numbers, because it's easy to get lost in the dizziness there. The bet is that the U.S. somehow can pump confidence into the global system. If that doesn't work, is there a plan B?
Confidence is in very, very short supply. This is the big problem. $700 billion. I mean, it's such a large amount of money. It would be the biggest state bailout ever. It is the biggest state bailout ever. That said, as you indicated, you look at the European markets today, and it appears to have had no effect at all. The amount of value being wiped off European shares and Asian shares is in the trillions of dollars. I mean, you said leave the numbers for a moment, but I have to just give you a few of them. The Nikkei in Japan down 4.3% to its lowest close since February 2004. Hong Kong's Hang Seng, that down 4.7%.
Huge numbers.
The Russian markets, as soon as they opened, within minutes of opening in Moscow, the main index was down some 7%. It's now down closer to 10%. And then you look at the main European bourses, the falls not as large in percentage terms, but all pretty much in excess of 4%, some quite substantially more. The London index almost 5%. And there's no sign of a stop to it.
Alex, I wonder if part of the reason is there's been an enormous amount of talk in media coverage over the weekend here in the United States, and it's emerged really over the last 10 days in financial reporting that these credit default swaps, which really took as their first casualty AIG, are worth something on the order of $60 trillion. That's how much money is on $62 trillion. I mean, $700 billion. You know, I can't even get a cup of coffee for that, Alex.
Yeah, the problem with these credit default swaps is that a lot of these big financial institutions were both selling and buying them in roughly equal measure. The aim of doing that being that they would make a bit of cash each time they sold or bought a credit default swap. But once you get banks actually collapsing, that means that any credit default swaps that they've sold to another bank become effectively worthless, or no one really knows what their worth will be. It all depends on whether someone else takes them over. And that means that any bank that covered itself, they're trying to get this sort of net zero position where they sell as many as they buy, but it means that any that they've bought from a bank that's now in trouble, they now can no longer pay out on their own credit default swaps. So the entire system is at fault. I mean,
between the worthlessness of the paper and the scariness of the obligation, it's a spiral that really it's hard to see how you pull out of it.
Well, the really scary part about this was that originally these credit default swaps are effectively insurance policies on corporate bonds, on corporate debts defaulting. But there were a lot of people who suddenly realized that these were actually very good investments in their own right. So you might think that there are a certain number of corporate bonds in the world to be insured, and if they go down, well, there's insurance to cover them. But actually, because these credit default swaps, if you buy them, if you pay the insurance premium, whether or not you own the bond, you can claim the payout. There were something like 30 times as many credit default swaps sold as there were corporate bonds to be insured. So the problem is then magnified by 20 or 30 fold.
I mean, if you sell insurance against your own stupidity, you're going to get a lot of buyers because people want that kind of insurance, right, Alex?
Well, and the other problem, of course, is that if you look at car insurance, you can have huge payouts and huge potential liabilities there because no one's you're never going to get a situation, or it'd be very unlikely, where everyone crashes their car at the same time. But of course, when you're talking about a financial crisis on this scale, it's only ever going to happen at once. And if it does happen at once, then the money just simply isn't there to pay it out.
That is the scary part. Alex Ritson describing an enormous sort of car crash happening at once in the global financial system. He's the BBC business correspondent joining us from London. Thank you, Alex.
John.
Adora.
John, meanwhile, while the global markets are feeling incredibly anxious, Secretary of the Treasury Henry Paulson is going to be getting down to business this morning now with access to potentially $700 billion to bail out the troubled U.S. financial markets. The question is, where does he start? And for that, we're going to turn to The Economist's U.S. economics editor, Greg Ip. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning.
So Secretary Paulson sits down at his desk this morning. He's looking at these numbers of the markets overseas falling. Where does he start?
Well, he's got $700 billion available potentially to him. First of all, $350 billion, and the second $350 billion available as long as Congress doesn't say no. And he's going to say, well, this market has a serious lack of confidence, and we have to start restoring that confidence by taking some of these dented and impaired mortgage assets off the hands of the banks, and therefore giving the banks good cash in return. And hopefully at that point, investors will say our banking system is sound, and lenders will resume lending, and the banks will no longer have any trouble getting funds of their own, and they will therefore resume lending to businesses and consumers.
And that's the macro view. Let's look at the actual mechanics.
Sure.
So how does he now set up a process for figuring out whether he's going to be buying mortgage-backed assets or credit default swaps and how the Treasury is going to value those things?
Well, let's take a look at the Act itself. It gives the Treasury Secretary extremely broad authority and flexibility to buy essentially anything he needs to settle down the crisis. The focus has been on buying mortgage-related assets, such as actual loans and mortgage-backed securities. And the expectation is that he will set up something like what we call a reverse auction, whereby there's one bidder, that is to say the federal government, and multiple sellers, which is all the people who own this paper. And the government will do something to the effect of, well, let's start out by buying $1 billion worth of this type of subprime mortgages. Let's have people offer paper to us. And some people will say, well, I have $100 million that I'll sell to you at 50 cents on the dollar. Somebody will say, well, I have that same amount for 60 cents on the dollar. And somebody else will say, well, I have that much for 70 cents on the dollar. And the government will therefore set up the auction and will start buying the paper, starting at the lowest price, and eventually keep buying it at higher prices until it's satisfied as much as it wants. And the theory is that by doing it this way, you will inject the amount of cash that you've promised to, but you will do it at the lowest possible price for the taxpayer. But that may not happen soon enough or in large enough scale to really help, so the Treasury Secretary may do other things, such as actually negotiating one-on-one with institutions for their mortgage paper and so forth. And if he finds that there are banks or other types of institutions that are on the verge of failing because of a lack of confidence, he can actually inject capital in the form of, for example, new common shares or preferred shares into that bank.
So he has a couple of choices as to how he goes about trying to shore up the markets. But let's talk about some of the big questions swirling around the people who are going to be executing this policy and issues of conflict of interest. Who does he get with the expertise to actually move this process forward without tainting the entire process with accusations of conflict of interest?
Well, for starters, the process will be handled out of the Treasury Department. They will set up a Office of Financial Stability, which is created by the Act, headed by an Assistant Treasury Secretary to oversee the process. So ultimately, it will be civil servants answerable to Congress who are going to be doing this. And their actions will in turn be overseen by a Financial Stability Oversight Board, which will be comprised of the Treasury Secretary and several other officials.
And how quickly do you think that Oversight Board can be put together?
Oh, in a matter of days. Mm-hmm. And it itself will be overseen by a Congressional Oversight Panel. And in an office of an inspector general, which will report separately to Congress. The actual management of the money, once they have it, will be a tricky thing because it's a lot of money, and you want to be able to sort of like know, well, we've got these mortgages. Should we hold on to them? Should we sell them? And a lot of that will be outsourced to companies that are considered to have expertise here. This will be a tricky process because most of the companies that are out there that have expertise in this area have been active in the business, and they might have conflicts of interest. For example, you would say that the government's main interest is to buy this stuff as cheaply as possible, but for anybody who actually already owns this paper or who consults to companies that own it, they might have an intrinsic interest in seeing the price go as high as possible.
Greg Ipp, thank you. Greg Ipp is the U.S. economics editor for The Economist. Many questions there, John.
And a lot of you freelance economists are talking about your own personal recession plans. Jade Rutanen says via email, unfortunately, the steps I have taken affect those around me. Being a business owner, I have had to downsize my company until the economy gets on track. That means working even more hours myself away from my small children as well.
We want to hear your story about your rescue plan, your bailout plan for your family. Does that mean less gifts this holiday season? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE. 869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Competing with the economy on the campaign trail are some other issues. Barack Obama palling around with terrorists, says Sarah Palin, or John McCain involved with the Keating Five, says Obama surrogates. Are these distractions or are they real issues? Here's another take from one of our listeners. Whether the allegations are true or not, it's not the issue. There's only one objective of a presidential campaign: to get elected. The ends justify the means. Do you agree? 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. Dora?
John, there might be some candidates who are thinking that at this point, as the final 4 weeks until Election Day means that there are many U.S. Senate candidates who are campaigning around the clock, particularly Republicans who are probably trying to figure out how to stump polls that have for weeks been indicating they will lose seats. One of those important races is in New Hampshire, where Republican incumbent John Sununu and former Democratic Governor Gene Shaheen, who lost to Sununu back in 2002, are in an intense race. Josh Rogers, political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio, joins us now with more. Good morning, Josh. We're talking about two professional, well-known candidates. Who's leading now?
Well, the average of the polls, I guess, would show former Democratic Governor Gene up by about 5 points. She's been up pretty much all the way. It's expected to be tight, though. John Sununu's a hardworking candidate, and both of them are very well-known.
Now, what's really driving the race there? Is it some local issues, or is it really the big national issues facing the country?
It's a mix, but predominantly it's been big national issues and the overhang of the presidential contest. You know, Democrats have been on a roll here basically since 2002, when Sununu defeated Shaheen, and Sununu defeated her then, he basically ran against her record as governor. She had been in for 3 2-year terms. This time, Shaheen has said it's going to be about Sununu's 6 years in the U.S. Senate, and a lot of that is linking John Sununu to the policies of the Bush administration over and over, ad infinitum, on issues ranging from spending in Iraq to taxes, and most recently to the regulatory climate that Gene Shaheen and other Democrats say led to the financial turmoil and the necessity of a bailout package.
Let's listen to Shaheen talking about that link between Sununu and Bush.
John Sununu's voted with George Bush 90% of the time on energy policy, on health care, on ending the war in Iraq. He's been on the wrong side of those issues from the perspective of the voters of New Hampshire.
And how has that gone down in New Hampshire? You're talking about 38% of the voters there who are not affiliated with any party.
That's true. Although most of those non-affiliated people tend to lean in a pronounced fashion towards Democrat or Republican, most of those people are probably leaning Democrat at this point. But that message seems to have been sticking. I was able to watch a focus group behind a two-way mirror that was being done with voters. It was predominantly about the presidential race, but then they threw a few Shaheen Sununu questions in and asked the respondents, or 12 voters across the spectrum politically, what do you think of these folks? And pretty much every, 10 of the 12 essentially said too close to Bush, too establishment, about John Sununu. They didn't necessarily have great things to say about Gene Shaheen either, but the Bush-Sununu linkage argument seemed to be taking root, at least with the folks that I was watching.
And that has essentially forced Sununu to spend a lot of time trying to distance himself from Bush. Let's listen to him.
I vote with New Hampshire 100% of the time. In 2003, I led a successful effort to defeat a Republican energy bill. In 2005, I led the effort to demand protections under the Patriot Act for personal freedom and civil liberties. People know I was the first Republican to call for Alberto Gonzalez to get fired.
I've taken Republican off my stationery in my office. I don't park near Republicans on Capitol Hill. Yeah, Josh, he's really doing it there.
Well, he's doing what he can. I mean, the 100% of the time voting with New Hampshire, I think that line's fallen a bit flat. But, you know, at every turn you ask him, can you say one nice thing about President Bush? And he launches into the litany of ways in which he differs from President Bush. And, you know, it's an albatross. Bush is obviously unpopular nationally, and he may be even more unpopular than the national averages up here.
How important do you think the debates between Sununu and Shaheen are going to be or have been? I think I read somewhere that they're going to meet in various forums somewhere between 8 and 10 times. And is that more than usual?
That does strike me as more than usual. I attended the first one that they had last week, and it was, you know, kind of tit for tat. Gene Cheney saying John Sununu is like George Bush, particularly now on spending and regulatory matters pertaining to Wall Street. He hits back with the same messages that he ran against her in 2002, which is when she was governor, she proposed a sales tax. New Hampshire doesn't have a sales tax, general sales tax or general income tax. And that has historically been, you know, essentially the dominant political issue here for decades. You know, it's hard to know what the half-life of Gene Shaheen's record as a so-called taxer is. This mm-hmm. will be a test of that. And it'll also be a test of there's been a fair amount of in-migration to the state. And, you know, in addition to the healthy slug of undeclared or independent voters here,
right.
The Democrats, I mean, in 2002 when Sununu defeated Shaheen, Republicans had a 12,000 voter edge in terms of just registered Democrat versus Republican. Now it's negligible, and it could be nothing by election day.
Well,
and in New Hampshire, we have same day registration, and you know Democrats and the Obama folks have been on the ground signing up new voters, young voters, and it's hard to know how many same day registrants we'll get.
Any questions? Thanks, Josh Rogers, political reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. He's been covering both John Sununu and Gene Shaheen on and off since 2000. Now we're going to turn to Richard Hake, who's got the latest headlines for us. Richard?
Adora, 28 minutes past the hour right now. The Treasury Department says it will increase its debt auctions to handle the $700 billion financial plan.
I love that.
It's also
they're going to borrow it.
It's also considering other options to handle the financing needs. It may reintroduce the 3-year note beginning next month. Meanwhile, share prices on the London Stock Exchange are down nearly 5% at midday there. U.S. stocks appeared headed for a decline as the credit markets remain under strain. And borrowers with countrywide mortgages may receive some relief. Bank of America will settle claims brought by 11 U.S. states against bad loans made by Countrywide. Countrywide was the largest U.S. mortgage lender before Bank of America acquired it for $4 billion back in July. Three European scientists are sharing the 2008 Nobel Prize in Medicine. Two of them worked together to discover HIV, while the other found the virus that causes cervical cancer. It's the first Monday in October, and that means the Supreme Court opens a new term today. The first order of business is expected to be turning down hundreds of appeals they decided not to pick up, followed by arguments over limits on lawsuits against tobacco companies. And finally, NASA is preparing to photograph the surface of the planet Mercury today. The spacecraft Messenger will fly over. They want to see if there's any ice there.
Smile, Mercury. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org and by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. Think about it. Every decade, there's been a big scientific theme that's had an impact on presidential politics. In the 80s, it was Star Wars and nuclear science. In the 90s, it was computer science and information technology. In the Bush administration, it's been climate science and the debate over global warming. What will it be for the next president? Maybe genetics. Today we're talking genetics with law expert Lori Andrews about what the next president needs to know about science and what aggressive policies perhaps need to be explored. Lori has also written the new genetic thriller called Immunity. She's a law professor in Chicago and the director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. And she joins us right here in the studio. Welcome, Lori.
Thank you.
And, you know, your book, Immunity, the idea of a popular thriller on genetics is actually germane to the question of whether science can deeply sort of embed itself in public consciousness. We're going to talk about that in a moment. But let's begin with the science and the new administration in January. Do you think genetics and biotech is the place where things are going to really transform and then an aggressive, scientifically valid policy in the beginning is going to be really important to most Americans?
I think it will, and we've got to add nanotechnology to that as well, because we're really transforming things at the molecular level. We're looking at technologies, even some of the things in monoclonal antibodies that have never been used before. We don't have a regulatory structure for it because we're designing things to rewire the human immune system, and yet it won't work in animals, and so you can't do animal testing. We've seen a lot of problems in the last administration with religion governing what scientists could say. But I don't think even if we get a Democratic administration, we can be complacent because commerce now is governing a lot of the research. It used to be taxpayer money was used to fund research at universities, and university researchers would go to jail if they used it for private gain. The rules changed with the passage of a law, and now we're seeing a lot more secrecy among university scientists, and it's hard to figure out who to turn to for a real opinion about science.
Well, let's tee up the genetic issue. I mean, here we are, a biotech which has all these utopian potentials and all these regulatory fears. Listen to this from the movie Gattaca.
Genetics, what can it mean? The ability to perfect the physical and mental characteristics of every unborn child.
And then there's this view from a protester in California in 2001.
There are early studies showing that a lot of the genetically engineered food causes cancer, infertility, birth defects, autoimmune disease, severe allergic reactions.
Politically, how do you navigate those poles? They're extreme and wide apart.
Well, I think we have to ask ourselves three questions as a society. How good are the technologies? Even if they're good, should they be used? And how do they change cultural concepts? So let's think about genetics since you just brought that up. The how good is it came out in the first OJ case. You know, can we use forensic DNA testing to really identify people? But even if it's good, there are certain situations we have to think about whether we should use it or not. If we find out that a 13-year-old girl is not really the biological daughter of her mother's husband, the mother had had an affair, do we take that 13-year-old away from the only parents she knew and give him back to a stranger because of the biological link? And I think we've been so seduced by technologies, we're applying them prematurely and without the sort of oversight. And then the third level of question is, how does it change cultural concepts?
Well, it seems to me that the OJ case really botched it in the sense that the popular understanding of DNA was set back in that this case just became a political firestorm. How is the federal government supposed to sit in the middle of all this and say, these are the technologies to watch, these are the things that are too politicized, these are the places where you should legitimately be scared?
I think we have to find some other cultural value than the cure approach. I find that any new technology, if there's any little hope it will extend the lifespan, we in the United States embrace it without putting a mechanism in place for follow-up. I mean, there have been recent court decisions where judges have actually said the FDA can no longer protect us. You see drugs going on the market and then being recalled. And so I think we need some monitoring of technologies, and we have to be skeptical when we hear that initial cure motif. And I think a historical perspective would help us to look at what happened to all the things we were promised. Gene therapy, what went wrong there? Fetal tissue transplantation, what went wrong there? So we're not seduced by each new technology. We need follow-up. We need a history of it.
So the mission of government should be, we need to know about this rather than we're going to find a cure for you kind of idea.
Right. That cure language just swamps any other cultural value.
Is there any agreement, though, among the science world that that's exactly what needs to happen, that there's oversight and this cautiousness in applying and using some of these developments?
I think right now there's so much of a chance to commercially benefit that we don't have neutral scientists we can turn to anymore. Columbia University. Researchers there actually found a test for a certain enzyme, but also learned a biological existing fact that a high level of the enzyme was related to a vitamin deficiency. They patented that fact, and now there are lawsuits against doctors for even thinking about that fact, people from writing about it. We're seeing basic science being commercialized. A researcher at Yale University was shut down who did research on breast cancer because a company claiming to own the breast cancer gene. So commercialization needs to be, you know, stripped away a bit so we can find people we can rely on.
Well, certainly something to watch is when the new administration names its science advisor, and, you know, maybe someday it'll be a cabinet-level position. Maybe something else to watch is if the sales of your book, Immunity, go through the roof, perhaps there's hope that people will begin to understand some of these issues. Is that your mission, partly, aside from selling books and out of academia, which is driving you crazy?
No. What happened is that I would win these pro bono cases, and the institution I'd sued would just change their informed consent form, or I'd go to Congress with people who lost their insurance and employment, even though they were healthy, because they had a gene related to a certain disease and might cost more in medical care later.
So I guess you imagine yourself as the John Grisham of biotech science. Laurie Andrews is a law professor in Chicago and the director of the Institute for Science, Law, and Technology at the Illinois Institute of Technology. Her new book of fiction on legal biotech is just out, Immunity, about a potentially legal bioweapon unleashed in the United States. Lethal bioweapon. Richard Hake has the headlines.
John, 21 minutes before the top of the hour, oil prices have fallen to an 8-month low of less than $90 a barrel. Meanwhile, the Treasury Department will increase the size of its debt auctions in the coming weeks to manage the $700 billion financial bailout. Wells Fargo is the winner in the latest tussle with Citigroup to take over Wachovia. A New York State appeals court overturned a verdict on Sunday that would have prevented Wells Fargo from acquiring Wachovia. The newest scandals in the presidential race are also some of the oldest, going back as far as 40 years. John McCain's campaign spent the weekend talking about Barack Obama's association with a 1960s radical. Meanwhile, Obama was talking about McCain's involvement in the Senate's Keating Five scandal from the early 90s. And lots of baseball news. The Angels are still alive. They beat the Red Sox 5-4 in 12 innings yesterday to avoid a sweep. The White Sox are also still in it. They beat Tampa Bay 5-3, but still trail 2-1. And the Brewers' hopes are no more. The Phillies eliminated Milwaukee from postseason with a 6-2 win. The Phillies will now play the Dodgers for a spot in the World Series.
And what about those Cubs? I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to laugh.
No, you're not.
It's a national tragedy. Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
Go, Joe Torre.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning. I'm Adora Udoji, and you're listening to The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and on the line is Elizabeth Holland from Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
You are two things, my mother-in-law,
yes,
which is fabulous, but the reason we're speaking with you this morning is you just got back from Obama camp in Boston on Saturday. Could you explain what that was all about?
That is training. 2,000 Massachusetts residents applied, and they picked a whole bunch of us to go be trained to then be sent off to battleground states to work with volunteers.
Now, camp, Obama camp, it seems to me a little, I don't know, was it fun? Was it indoctrination? What were they doing there?
It was fun. It was inspirational. It was practical, all about, you know, organizing volunteers, why we're doing this, how to do it, stories about volunteers. It was just very exciting.
Did you drink any Kool-Aid?
No Kool-Aid.
Glad to hear it. Did they talk a little bit about where you might be deployed? I mean, your demographic, I think, is pretty interesting from their perspective. Could you elaborate?
Even the fact that I'm 65 and retired and
right,
a very enthusiastic Obama supporter. They talked about states, New Hampshire, of course, Pennsylvania possibly, but people were talking about going to Colorado and Florida and any place else that needs us.
Now, was the buzz at the camp about McCain pulling out of Michigan last week?
Not at all. the buzz was all positive about Obama and about what we can do.
What about the fact that the Republicans have a reputation for being much better organized in the base when push comes to shove on Election Day?
You know, we didn't talk about the Republicans at all. We talked about what we can do and how powerful this army that's being prepared is going to be.
So it was a room full of nice senior citizens like yourself and a bunch of college kids, right?
That's what I thought when I went there. But I was really surprised that there were not that many of me, the retired people, and not that many college kids. They were there. But there were business people who are giving up their business, either taking time off from their job, or one woman I met is closing down her business for 4 weeks to go work for Obama.
Really? And these are people in their like 40s and 50s, 30s and 40s?
30s, 40s, I would say mostly.
And what does that tell you?
Well, it surprised me first that people are that excited about this race that they will close down their business or leave their law firm for 3 or 4 weeks to go work on this campaign.
Now, what was your first political campaign, quickly, before we go?
Do I have to admit this?
Yes, you do. You do.
I was in elementary school, and I worked for Stevenson.
Adlai Stevenson. Wow. So you go way back.
Yeah.
Now, you know, I'm trying to remain objective here. You know, you are my mother-in-law. Does this mean that I have to support McCain as a sort of equal time?
Well, we're not supposed to get along anyway. So you can do whatever you want to.
Including taking my two oldest daughters on the campaign trail with you next weekend?
Absolutely. I'm going to do that.
Oh,
I was pretty young when I started in this passion, and I want them to, too.
Well, good luck to my daughters and me and you. Elizabeth Holland, mother-in-law and field organizer for the Obama campaign, just back from camp. Thanks, Mom.
Thanks, John. Bye.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 6th, and Richard Hake is just joined us, sitting in for Femi Oke, and he's got the latest headlines this morning.
Adora, good morning. It's 11 minutes before the top of the hour right now. Oil prices dropped to an 8-month low of under $90 a barrel, reflecting fears of the spreading financial crisis will worsen a global economic slowdown and cut demand. Overall trading is down in Europe's financial markets, with the same likely to happen on Wall Street. Asia's markets already closed with losses. Meanwhile, according to the Associated Press, they just said President's top advisors say the financial markets remain extremely strained.
It's nice to know they're paying attention.
Well, the Supreme Court, that opens a new term today. It's the first thing that they're expected to do is formally deny hundreds of appeals today. The first case to be argued deals with limits on lawsuits against tobacco companies. Three European scientists are sharing the 2008 Nobel Prize in Medicine. Two of them worked together to discover HIV, while the other found the virus that causes cervical cancer. And a new government report finds that more children have died from the flu because they also had staph infections. Public health officials say the numbers underscore the importance of a brand new recommendation that all children from 6 months through 18 get routine flu shots. Staph germs commonly live harmlessly in the nose or skin without causing illness, but according to the CDC, combined with the flu, it could become
deadly. That's a big story.
That is. That is.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
John, here's something I want you to consider. In 1936, Congress opened up the post office to banking services. So that essentially meant anyone could open an account, they'd put their money in, and they would get a fixed percentage return. Good idea?
Well, I don't know. It sounds like I just put the money in an envelope, put a stamp on it, and hand it to the post office.
You could do it any way that you'd like.
Wow.
But then Congress went and abolished that program in 1966. Michael Lind, a senior Whitehead fellow at the New America Foundation, says perhaps America should reconsider this as the big banks and financial firms struggle. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning.
So give us your best
argument. What would that look like, opening up the post office to be used as a bank?
Well, the idea is reviving the U.S. postal system, which we had actually from 1911 to 1967, would not compete with the commercial banks. It would add an added layer of financial security for most Americans who'd be allowed to have small deposits with government-backed returns. We could use that money, as other countries do. Most countries in the world have postal savings systems, and those the deposits are used only to fund to buy shares of the national debt and also to invest in national infrastructure. If you look at China, Japan, the post-communist countries of Eastern Europe, most of the European countries, they have these systems. So it doesn't replace the existing commercial bank system, but it provides an extra layer.
Give us some context as to why the whole program was abolished in the 60s.
Well, people were secure at that point. They were reassured by the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance, and also the post office offered fairly low rates of return, just of 2% on deposits. But one of the major factors was in the 50s and 60s, we had a lower proportion of foreign-born immigrants than we had at the beginning of the 20th century and than we have today. Today, we have nearly 1 in 10 Americans is unbanked. Many of these are immigrants who live in a purely cash economy. If we could bring them into the banking system through a revived postal banking system, they would no longer be preyed upon by predatory lenders and by unscrupulous credit card companies. And you would generate a lot of money that could be used for investment, where we need to spend, by some estimates, $300 billion a year mm-hmm. on infrastructure.
Interesting conversation, or at least I think it was, that John and I were having earlier today. And you mentioned a 2% return. About now, given this economy, there's a whole lot of people as well as companies that would love to get a 2% return.
Yeah, Citicorp would love that.
Well, that's right. And if you had a Treasury inflation-protected bonds, for example, you could be assured that your money would be safe. It wouldn't be a high return, but it would be an utterly safe investment. And so many middle-class and affluent people might want to open up deposits in a revived postal savings system as well.
Michael, any real discussion about this in the political world? Do you think there's any political will quickly to take on and consider, discuss this option?
Well, it's a provocative idea that I'm just launching, but I anticipate there will be a lot of interest in it because we've seen the confidence in the existing financial system has been destroyed. Now, the immediate mm-hmm. crisis is to recapitalize the banks, you know, to get lending going. But I think in the aftermath of this crisis, there's going to be a lot of interest in taking a second look at our entire financial system and considering novel ideas like reviving the postal savings system.
Michael Lind, we thank you for your time and your thoughts this morning.
Thank you.
Michael Lind is a senior Whitehead Fellow at the New America Foundation, where he directs the American Infrastructure Initiative. And food for thought there, John.
Banking going postal. Think about that. But we want to leave you with the other big economic story this morning. Oil is at an eight-month low, below $90 a barrel. Joining us now is Carol Ahoyas, chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times from London. Carol, this is a really important story, not only because it's a spike downward, which normally we would think of as good news, but because it's a real indicator of the persistence and the fears of a global recession.
You've said it all. What would you like to ask me? That's exactly right. It is. It's this reflection that worries people. The reason we're down is that generally people believe that in the U.S. and in Europe, as the crisis worsens, we're not going to do things like go on holiday and take plane rides, and we're going to downgrade to smaller cars or commuting, and we just won't be able to spend that kind of cash. The other big problem that we're beginning to see is this fear that this is spreading beyond our borders, and that China, the other big engine of demand, the U.S. and China being the two big ones, Chinese the one, of course, that's growing most quickly, may start to slow. And if that happens, the second pillar falls on the demand side, and there'll be relatively little one can do to prop up prices. And of course, that then falls to OPEC, and we'll see what they do in Algeria in December. But they're not a very organized organization.
Well, I'm not an architect, and you can't really support much with just two pillars anyway. But it's mm-hmm. shocking to me how you go in just 3 months from assuming that Chinese demand demand and demand from South Asia is relatively infinite in the energy sector, to now thinking that, oh, it's going to go away along with Europe and with North American demand. I mean, normally these cycles are much, much slower, it seems to me.
Yeah, well, I mean, last time around in 1997, when Asia collapsed, it was pretty aggressive and pretty quick. And even the Saudis, who have arguably the best data available, at least on the supply side, got it wrong. And we went to $8 a barrel. I thought you were going to say it's funny how we're talking about $89, $90 a barrel and thinking it's not necessarily a high oil price.
That's funny, too. There you go. There's a lot of comedy in this.
Right. Yeah. Is there anything good about that, Carola?
Well, I was trying to think about this when I was thinking about the winners and losers. And one of the areas that is going to lose is, depending on how you look at it, is either good or bad. One of the things that was happening was that the very, very highly expensive projects that oil companies were going into, like the Canada oil sands, were terribly controversial from an environmental point of view. So it could be that that if these kind of projects start being delayed, of course some of them are already underway, then some environmentalists will be relatively happy. On the other hand, as the oil price falls, unfortunately, charity and the environment pretty much go out of the window pretty quickly as well. Even the other things, people who were uncomfortable with these dollars moving to the Middle East at the rapid rate that they were going with the increase in the petrodollar may be a little relieved, but not really, because as you said, John, right at the beginning of this, the biggest problem with this is it's a reflection of the health of the economy, and it's not a very pretty one.
Well, we have to go, but it's really interesting that, you know, we're talking about domestic instability in places where the oil price is spiking downward, places like Russia and Venezuela, and also that exploration stalls almost immediately. So we might need new sources of fossil fuel, but they're not going to be explored at these prices. Carola Hoyas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Bye.
Carola Hoyas is chief energy correspondent for the Financial Times. She joined us for London talking about record low oil prices. Record low, yeah, still $89 a barrel.
We're always on at the Takeaway, and Election Day is a little more than 4 weeks away. We've got you covered. Check out vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
How are you recession-proofing your life?
I'm not buying less holiday presents because I'm trying to be optimistic, but who knows?
Tell us your recession-proofing plans at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
Here's your takeaway for today.
You're never going to get a situation, what would be very unlikely, where everyone crashes their car at the same time. But of course, when you're talking about a financial crisis on this scale, it's only ever going to happen at once.
That's Alex Ritson, BBC business correspondent, talking about the economic crisis and credit default swaps.
And 10 years ago today, Matthew Shepard was brutally murdered. Shepard was a gay student attending the University of Wyoming. His death galvanized the gay community around the world. On our site, you'll be able to listen to our conversation with John Barrett, editor-in-chief of The Advocate magazine.
And also, John Barrett will be taking your questions at 1 p.m. Eastern in a live chat on our website. But you can send your questions to mytake@thetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
Eurobanks belly up, Asian sell-off, credit crisis ripples across the globe.
It's a world of laughter, a world of tears. It's a world of hopes and a world of kisses.
World of tears. It's a small world, after all, in the global financial crisis. The shrinking world is matched only by the shrinking dollar and euro. No place to hide. Global warming? Try global freeze. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Monday. It's October 6th. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Adora.
Today, a report about the real economy. Apparently, the anxiety has trickled down. Consumers are spending less on eating out, buying clothes, and plane tickets. We'll have a report. Also, House races across the country. Republicans are trying to figure out how to stem the expected losses. Sports, they're feeling the pain from the economy there, too, from the basketball court to the driving track. We'll take a look at what they're most worried about. And 10 years since the young gay college student, Matthew Shepard, was murdered. Much has been learned. Those stories are coming up. But first, here are some headlines.
World markets aren't reacting well to government intervention either here or abroad. Main indexes in France, Germany, and Britain are down about 6%. The Nikkei in Tokyo fell to its lowest level in more than 4 years, closing down more than 4%. Oil prices below $90 a barrel. That's an eight-month low, and it comes as fears that an economic slowdown will bring a cut in demand for crude all over the world.
And one of the things the markets are reacting to is Germany's announcement. It will guarantee all private savings accounts. The German finance ministry is also pumping $70 billion into one of the country's biggest mortgage banks, Hypo Real Estate. There may be some relief for people stuck with countrywide financial mortgages. In the largest deal ever to modify home loans, Bank of America has settled with 11 states to allow hundreds of thousands of countrywide customers to move their variable rate mortgages to a fixed 6%.
Supreme Court set to say uh-uh to hundreds of appeals they've decided not to take up. It's the Supreme Court's new term opening this morning, first Monday in October. The Nobel Prize for Medicine was announced this morning. It's been split between three Europeans, German Harold Zurhausen for his work on the causes of cervical cancer, and French scientist Françoise Bazare-Sinouzi and Luc Montagnier for their discovery of the HIV virus.
On the campaign trail over the weekend, Sarah Palin accused Barack Obama of associating with terrorists. Obama said the attacks are a distraction.
So I can understand why Senator McCain would want to turn the page and ignore the economy. But I also know this. You're trying to pay your bills every week and stay above water. You can't ignore the economy.
Obama and John McCain face off again in another debate tomorrow night in Nashville. McCain has an event in Albuquerque later today.
Baseball. The Angels beat the Red Sox in extra innings. The White Sox beat Tampa Bay 5-3. Still trail 2-1. The Brewers are out. The Phillies beat Milwaukee 6-2. Teams are set in the National League. The Dow closed down 1.5% on Friday and is set to open lower this morning. Also, the S&P set to open at 1099. Futures pointing lower.
Palin says Barack Obama's palling around with terrorists. Obama says McCain has some former troubles of his own. Is all this talk a distraction? What do you think? 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Star Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information about the Foundation's digital initiatives at knightfoundation.org, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. To get a sense about how consumers are feeling in this struggling economy, we turn now to Lou Uchitel, a New York Times reporter, and his team, who report today in the New York Times that sales are down from auto dealers to restaurants and airline tickets, that indeed people are feeling anxious. He reports that the consumer spending for this quarter will almost certainly shrink, the first quarterly decline in nearly two decades. Lou, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, sir. Can you give us an overview of what's happening? At times, almost feels like the sky is falling, is it?
Well, no, it's a little bit falling more than usual. Let me say, first of all, that story is a team effort by a number of reporters talking to consumers all over the country. The sky is falling, and it falls gradually. What we're getting now is the fallout from the credit crunch affecting workers. For example, a company depends on credit to pay salaries until because they don't have enough money from sales. Revenue comes in slowly, so you can't pay. You can't get the credit. You can't pay the salaries. There are layoffs. People all over the country are shocked by what's going on. I would say that's the biggest impact on consumers. And they, even if they can afford, they have jobs and everything is the same as before. As a precaution, they cut back. They're not buying the car they have runs very well, so they're not trading it in. They're not buying as much clothing. They're not taking the trips they were taking before. They're not flying on. They're not taking trips by commercial airline. That traffic is way off. So it's a shock effect.
Yeah, in fact, some airlines have cut up to 10% of their domestic seats in response. Do you find it particularly disturbing that, like, for example, there have been a couple of companies like Pier One who have scrapped providing any sales estimates through the end of the year? What does that say to you, Lou?
It says that people don't know what's next. And the worst part of it is if Pier One or anyone else can't, or Walmart or anyone else can't sell as much, they send their employees home, their sales clerks home, their associates, as Walmart calls them. And if they send them home without pay, then those people can't buy and spend, and the whole effect multiplies. So this is something that starts with a credit crunch, that is a great reluctance of banks now to lend, tightening credit considerably. And it spreads then through the economy. I did a story last week about companies that need credit in order to expand sales, and they can't, and some of them can't get it anymore. So each time you cut something back, somebody else is affected, either their employment, their sales, their investment, and that's what's going on now.
And just to go to the psychology, Eva, take it one step further. This week, millions of Americans are going to get in the mail statements from their 401k or from their pension accounts, and clearly the vast majority of them are going to see some real hits following what's been happening on the stock market.
That's true, and that means that they'll say to themselves, well, we better not go away for Christmas or Thanksgiving. We better try to rebuild our pension accounts. And the hardest hit, of course, are elderly people who, in theory, over a 30-year period, with their money partly invested in the stock market, should be able to save more than enough for retirement. But if the retirement comes at a moment when the market is plunging, they're hurt.
But amidst all this doom and gloom, there are some companies that you and your team noted that are doing quite well, and that would be some of the entertainment companies. You want to explain that?
Well, people, I think during the Depression, everybody went to the movies. And I guess during this downturn, to take your mind off what's happening to you, you go to Netflix or somebody, and you get yourself movies, or you go... You do something that distracts you, and that's entertainment.
But Lewis, you know, one of the things that's interesting there, and we were talking about this earlier, is compared with the Depression, the amount of money it costs to do that kind of basic entertainment is a much bigger percentage of salary, particularly if you're talking about sports tickets. I'm wondering if these entertainment companies are maybe, looking at some rough waters if this recession or whatever you want to call it persists.
Well, I would agree with that 100%. My main point would be that the credit crunch right now, that is Wall Street and the banks, are getting most of the headlines as they fail or have to be recapitalized, and we have this $700 billion bailout package aimed at the markets. Meanwhile, slowly, gradually, the impact is spreading through the country, and exactly what you just mentioned, that people will not be able to afford even the entertainment. But it'll go to right down to the corner coffee shop.
Okay, Lou, always a pleasure to have you on.
It was a pleasure to be on. Thank
Lou
you very much.
Lou Uchitel from the New York Times. He's got an article on the front page today, along with two others from the New York Times, reporting on consumer confidence in the marketplace right now.
Louis Uchitel is like everybody's best buddy. It's like he knows Main Street America. So he's sort of walking around there with a couple of shopping bags and a microphone. Anyway, we turn now to, speaking of distractions, and Liz was talking about that a moment ago, if you listen to the campaign this weekend, you'd think there was no economic crisis at all. Joining us now is Jeff Zeleny of the New York Times. It appears that both campaigns, or at least the McCain campaign explicitly, wants to change the message away from the economy to something else. Jeff, what is it the McCain campaign is going for at this point?
Well, good morning. In the final month of the campaign, of this very long campaign, the advisors for Senator John McCain have said that they are going to press the issue of Senator Obama's character. They are going to really raised the question of who Senator Barack Obama is. You heard it through the language of Governor Sarah Palin as she was out campaigning this weekend. You've seen it through ads and other things. So for the next 30 days, as the economy is the main story, there are going to be questions about who Senator Obama really is. The Obama campaign, of course, is saying that this is a distraction. We should not be turning the page from these financial issues. But today, the Obama campaign is striking back and reprising John McCain's role in the 1980s and early 90s in the Keating Five scandal.
The savings and loan scandal.
Things are heating up. Going forward.
Well, as you noted last week when we spoke to you, the economy does seem to be trending towards Obama, and a lot of battleground states aren't looking so battlegroundish anymore. But explain for us what this accusation is on the part of the McCain campaign. It was something that was floated by Rush Limbaugh and others on conservative talk radio, his association with an individual who was a member of the Weather Underground.
That's right. That's one of the claims, but basically, a gentleman from Chicago by the name of Bill Ayers, he was a member of the Weather Underground, a radical group in the 1960s. He's from Chicago. He's since become a school reformer in Chicago. He's very close to Mayor Daley. He's led school reform efforts in Chicago. Well, the Republicans and Senator McCain are trying to link him to Senator Obama. They live fairly close to each other. They have had an association somewhat, but Senator Obama points out, look, I was 8 years old when this happened in the 1960s. This issue is not new. It came up in the primary campaign with Senator Clinton. Senator Obama was asked about it during a couple debates.
And it didn't work
really
for Clinton.
Reprised.
It didn't work for Clinton, so what makes the McCain folks think that this is somehow going to gain traction just weeks before the campaign in the midst of all this economic madness?
Well, that was a Democratic primary, and this is a general election, so the electorate is certainly much different. But you're absolutely right. I mean, there are some Republicans who think this may backfire on them because the economy still remains the elephant in the room, if you will, and it's something that voters want to talk about. So I'm not sure that this will work, but the Obama campaign is obviously concerned enough that it is raising something that so far it has not talked much about.
Well, they certainly don't want to end up
role in the savings and loan scandal.
They certainly don't want to end up like Senator Kerry, who didn't really respond to Swift Boat until it was too late. But I guess the question really is, these kinds of charges work in a Rove style, a Karl Rove style, extremely divided electorate. If it's not really divided, and there's strong momentum in Obama's favor, this looks much more like a desperation ploy. And I don't want you to speculate, but quickly before we go, what do you think?
Well, some of these states where Senator Obama appears to have a lead, in Pennsylvania, in Ohio, in Indiana, there are still questions about who he is. People are not that familiar with him. So I think something like this, no question, can help on the margins, help Senator McCain and raise questions about Senator Obama. But the economy is on the mind of voters.
Getting into the minds on the margins. Thanks for joining us, Jeff Zeleny. Jeff Zeleny covers the campaign with our partner, The New York Times. Thanks, Jeff.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MYTAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, asking what is responsibility in this day and age? Everybody has their own opinion, discussions, and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. Quick look at the presidential campaign. Palin is basically a talking puppet, says Joan Thomas on our email. Speaking of Obama and domestic terrorism is a desperate move. Say it ain't so, Sarah. Obama supporters are talking about John McCain and the Keating Five. Is all this talk a distraction from the real issues?
I'm Don Merrill from Salt Lake City, Utah. I don't even have the words to describe how despicable and pathetic it is that both candidates have to focus on these kind of trivialities while the nation is going down economically and while the nation has suffered politically and morally. It's just despicable. It's like, is this the best we can do?
Register your disgust at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
435 members of Congress are facing re-election, as they do every 2 years, and they are well aware that voters are facing much anxiety as the economy struggles. Republicans are also facing tough polls, indicating they're likely to lose seats, not to mention now they have to go home and explain this unpopular Bush administration bailout plan, or at least it was widely unpopular last week. For the latest on the House races, we turn to Dave Wasserman, the House editor for the Cook Political Report. Thanks for being with us, Dave.
Good to be with you.
So give us an overview. Everyone's up, all 435 members, but clearly there are some races that are tighter than others.
Well, John and Adora, if you think it's silly season at the presidential level, it's even sillier season in down ballot races. Candidates are willing to throw everything but the kitchen sink at each other. We're really starting to see these races turn ugly because, for one, they have to compete for attention with the presidential race, and a lot of these candidates aren't particularly well known, and the only way to do it is to make a big splash. But overall, there are several structural factors that are working in Democrats' favor this year, the largest of which is the political environment overall, but also the high number of Republican retirements that pretty much sets Republicans back 5 to 10 seats to begin with. And overall, we forecast that they could lose between 10 and 20.
Well, that's certainly a huge spread, but let's just deconstruct that a bit. Prior to the past couple of weeks of the financial crisis deepening and the Bush administration's plan to step in, there was this sense that Republicans were trending towards losing some seats. How much more complicated are things now for those same Republicans in trying to explain what they decided to do about the crisis?
Well, a couple things. First of all, I think Republicans clearly stood more to lose from staying in town longer. It is the Republicans who need to go back to their districts and distance themselves from the image of the Republican Party, which is more in the gutter than the image of the Democratic Party, and they don't have as much time to do so. Second of all, I think not just the positions that politicians have staked out on the bailout, but more so the heightened focus on the economy in general has left Republicans in a much tougher place. They
stand to receive the
brunt of the blame for the bad economic situation in general, since they are the incumbent party in the White House. And I think congressional races are playing out in voters' eyes through the lens of the presidential race to some extent.
Dave, can I hit you with a particular race to take a look at?
Sure.
Which I think seems emblematic. Christian Gillibrand, who's a freshman Democrat up in New York, the only member of the New York Democratic delegation to vote no both times on the bailout, has to explain her no vote in a Republican district that's very sensitive about the economy. And, you know, she's on pins and needles up there anyway. How is she sort of emblematic of the tough situation that a lot of these congressmen are in explaining their votes?
Well, first of all, Kirsten Gillibrand has developed a record so far in Congress in her first term of putting distance between herself and her party. So far, it seemed to have served her well politically, but this is dicey politics. Anything called a bailout is unpopular in the majority of districts. But in districts in New York, which are particularly sensitive to the goings-on of Wall Street, this could be a move that puts her in slightly more jeopardy than she would have been in. But she was doing quite well. You have to understand that for the majority of Democratic freshman members of Congress, they really haven't been in town long enough to accumulate some of the blame for what voters perceive to be wrong in Washington. In other words, the time for change message is not necessarily as strong against them as it is against some longer-term members of Congress.
Right. Let me ask you this. You started off by saying that you think there's a spread between 10 and 20 seats that Republicans can potentially lose. What factors do you think are going to drive which it is, and what should we be paying attention to as the days march towards Election Day?
Well, absolutely. I think the presidential race will be the biggest factor in this. The name of the game for members of Congress in Democratic-leaning districts. Republican members of Congress in Democratic-leaning districts will be winning crossover votes as Obama does better at the top of the ticket, and it's looking like it is trending towards him, at least for now. Then I think Republicans have a much steeper hill to climb in winning 50% plus one in down ballot races. Likewise, Democrats who are sitting in Republican districts, if McCain is doing better, mm-hmm. they will have to convince a higher number of voters to cross over down ballot and vote for them. So I think if this presidential race is tied by Election Day, then Democrats stand to gain about 10 seats. If Obama is winning by what we'd consider a landslide now of 2 or 3 points nationally, Democrats may be looking at gains of closer to 20.
Dave Wasserman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Dave Wasserman, House editor of the Cook Political Report. And now we are going to Richard Hake for some headlines at this hour. He is sitting in for Femi Oke. Richard.
Adora, good morning. 28 minutes past the hour right now. The Treasury Department says it will increase its debt auctions to handle the $700 billion rescue program for the country's financial system. It's also considering options to handle the financing needs. It may reintroduce the three-year note beginning next month. Share prices on the London Stock Exchange are down nearly 5% at midday. U.S. stocks appear headed for a decline at the open of the market, which is in just a couple of minutes. Borrowers with countrywide mortgages may receive some relief. Bank of America will settle claims brought by 11 U.S. states against bad loans made by Countrywide. Countrywide was the largest U.S. mortgage lender before Bank of America acquired it for $4 billion back in July. It's the first Monday in October, and that means the Supreme Court opens a new term today. The first order of business is expected to be turning down hundreds of appeals they decided not to pick up, followed by arguments over limits on lawsuits against tobacco companies. And finally, 7/8 to Alaska Governor Sarah Palin say they'll testify in an investigation over whether Palin abused her powers by firing a commissioner who wouldn't fire her former brother-in-law. Palin is fighting the investigation, saying it's become too political.
Thank you, Richard.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home, auto, and life insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everyone. In the early going on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is following Asian and European markets seriously south. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is down about 279 points, could dip below 10,000, but that's just the opening. The S&P is down more than 2%. In our ongoing look at slices of the electorate in the campaign, we now turn to our friend Dante Chinney of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project. The project uses demographic information to look at America beyond state lines. No more red state, blue state business. It's a look at patches and collections of people with all kinds of shared characteristics. And today, Chinney tells us about the affectionately labeled moneyed burbs, the suburbs, or maybe now they're not so moneyed with the latest economic crisis. First, Dante, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
And, you know, it's an interesting group to take a look at today because I would suspect that these folks are very much interested in what's going on in their 401k, very much interested in the issues on the bailout or rescue plan, and perhaps feeling as insecure as anyone in the U.S. electorate.
Yeah, that's true. Up until the last couple of weeks when we started to have all the tumult in Wall Street, these are the people that, you know, as the economy went south over the last year, were thinking, well, this is bad, and I don't like the way things are going, but we're going to be okay, but I'm a little nervous. And then what's happened in the last couple of weeks is these people in particular are people tend to be the most invested in the stock market in one way or another. They're starting to look at 401k statements and thinking about retirement and college for the kids. And, you know, it's not as though they're going to be living in a cardboard box anytime soon, but there's the concern that, geez, I've been planning a lot of things, and it doesn't look like they're going to work out the way I want them to.
Well, what it looks like is that this financial crisis has sort of pulled these people from their moorings, largely Republican, but also Democratic, and they're certainly looking at alternatives. Let's listen to Jim Rickman from Los Alamos, New Mexico, who's, you say, emblematic of this group, and let's see what's on his mind.
Now, I think there's a heck of a lot of concern right now about what's going on in the stock market and what's going to happen to those pensions. And you know, you and I and everybody else knows that if you're retiring right now and you've got either a pension fund that's got investments or a 401k that you're going to cash in, you're pretty screwed. I'm sorry, I shouldn't have said screwed.
Hey, we wouldn't be on the air if he said what he was really thinking, I have a feeling. So, Dante, what do you think this group feels about the rescue? Is a yes vote on the rescue a good thing? How are they evaluating John McCain and Barack Obama?
I think, like a lot of the rest of the country, they don't like the fact that we had to do the rescue, but this is a group that feels that probably understands that something needed to be done, you know, as much or more than most of the other groups in the country. You know, it's like, look, something, if we don't like this, something has to happen. We can't just, the market can't collapse. You know, and what do they think about how they've handled it? It's curious. I was out in Los Alamos as, you know, the whole debate hokey-pokey situation was going on with John McCain. And these were people who looked at what was happening, and I'm going to go step into Washington and fix the problem where McCain was concerned. You know, and they were just like, I don't understand what he's doing. Why is he doing this? Yeah, and I told them I wasn't really sure either. But they were the people who looked at it and didn't understand McCain's response. Obama, these are the people who were leaning Obama maybe before. They've seen some of the stuff that's happening now. In fact, Los Alamos in particular is really a mixed bag. We weren't sure what we were going to see there in November, and it looks like it's starting to follow Obama now, and primarily because of the economy.
And it sounds like what they were reacting to is not so much a policy issue but a style, in the sense that John McCain maybe looked a little sort of all over the map, whereas Barack Obama, by kind of staying above the fray, made people feel more secure. It really wasn't about their specific policies, it sounds like you're saying.
Yeah, that's definitely policies. I don't even know, you know, how much these, especially in Los Alamos, these are very bright people. But, you know, when you get right down to it and you talk to them about the sense that we need change, something that comes out of their mouths. And Obama, you're right, the way he handled this, just kind of the idea of a steady hand at this particular point, you know, in the economy is very appealing to these people.
And McCain didn't come up with it. Well, we can deconstruct this group here. Employment, according to you, and we can see this on the Patchwork Nation website, is, 9.3% are professional. You got 28% in trades and services. 13% of these folks are government workers, maybe only about 1% in agriculture, and only about 4.9% of families in this moneyed burbs group are in poverty. Can you tell me, and before we go, where in what battleground states this group is likely to be most decisive?
This interesting. This group matters in a lot of key states. This is a big group in Pennsylvania. This is the area around Philadelphia. This is the big group in Michigan, which we now know John McCain has pulled out of. This is also a big group in Ohio, in that there aren't a lot of them, but they're very dense, and they're around Cleveland and they're around Cincinnati. It's two pretty big centers there. And, you know, Wisconsin, there are a lot of these places in Wisconsin. So up around the industrial Midwest, you have a lot of these moneyed burbs, and the way they break is going to be critical. And if they're really starting to break Obama, like we saw in Los Alamos, that's very bad news for John McCain.
Well, the moneyed burbs apparently are in motion, according to Dante Chinney of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project. Dante, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Dante Chinney of the Christian Science Monitor's Patchwork Nation Project is linked to our website at thetakeaway.org. Just go to our site and look for the Patchwork Nation link. And now the markets are bouncing off the bottom, but they're still down, right, Richard Hake? Here with the headlines?
They certainly are, John. Stocks are down substantially worldwide, not only on Wall Street. Economic turmoil also has oil prices falling under $90 a barrel for the first time in 8 months. The Treasury Department will increase the size of its debt auctions in the coming weeks to manage the $700 billion financial bailout. Congress is also holding hearings starting today to find out what went wrong. Set to testify is the CEO of Lehman Brothers. Wells Fargo is the winner in the latest tussle with Citigroup to take over Wachovia. A New York State appeals court overturned a verdict on Sunday that would have prevented Wells Fargo from acquiring Wachovia. The Nobel Prize for Medicine has been split between one German and two French scientists for their work on the causes of cervical cancer and on AIDS.
The Nobel Assembly has today decided to award the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine 2008, with one half to Harald Zurhauser for his discovery of human papillomaviruses causing cervical cancer, and the other half jointly to Françoise Barrès-Sinoussi and Luc Montagnier for their discovery of human immunodeficiency virus.
That was the announcement made earlier by Professor Hans Gorvil, the secretary for the Nobel Committee on Physiology and Medicine. This is the first day in a week of Nobel announcements. Also, police in Tijuana found 10 more bodies of murder victims over the weekend. This ends a week in which 49 people have been killed in the city due to drug-related violence. Last week, the Mexican president, Felipe Calderon, asked Congress to pass a series of measures to lessen drug-related crimes
in
Mexico.
Richard, this just in from our audience. We've got actually an alternative to the rescue plan. I wanted to run this by you.
Okay,
why are we bailing out the companies that attributed to the problems we have today? Give every American taxpayer $2 million to stimulate our economy and mortgage companies. Give every American $2 million. That would only cost $400 billion. What do you think?
I see a lot of flat-screen TVs out there, a lot of new cars.
Yeah, and America just chugging along.
Bye, bye.
That's a plan delivered at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and as we've been speaking about this morning, some people in times of economic crisis take refuge in entertainment. But the entertainment industry, particularly the sports sector of the entertainment industry, may not be positioned to take advantage of that. Joining us now is John Lombardo, who's a staff writer for Sports Business Journal. John, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Sports businesses are seeing some pretty disturbing trends in the ticket price and attendance numbers and purchasing of products that are related to their various sports. Run down the list for us, will you?
Well, it's interesting because it's always been a recession-proof industry, and you know, Major League Baseball was short of their projections this year. There's just been a number of teams who are struggling to sell tickets. Even in the bulletproof NFL, there's a concern about hitting revenue numbers. Teams are seeing a drop in some very lucrative sponsorships. Golf, obviously, with so close ties to financial services, is very, very concerned about what's going to happen to their revenues. So there's, for the first time, there's really a counter to the recession-proof sports area.
And it's happening on both sides. I mean, the NFL, it's more of a retail trade issue where you're talking about retailers and eyeballs. For golf, it's much more of a sponsorship advertising issue where people buy ads on programs or actually sponsor the events. Both are affected, it sounds like, equally.
Yeah, it is. You know, one-third of all golf tournaments are sponsored or entitled by financial services companies. And that's a big dependence. You know, you combine that, you know, it's interesting. In the same year that ratings, sort of a double whammy, Tiger Woods, you know, gets injured and ratings are down by a third because of his absence. And then you've got this big concern about the drop-off in spending among financial services who are so heavily involved with the PGA. There's real cause for concern here.
Maybe what will happen, John, is that they'll have, like, the Paulson Classic, you know, somewhere out in, like, in Palm Springs.
I think short-term there's some concerns. Long-term, I think there is a sense that, you know, golf and businesses are golf and the financial services business is so closely aligned that I think there will be some recovery, but it's certainly under siege right now.
Let's talk NASCAR for a moment. They like to position themselves as the largest sporting event or the sporting event with the biggest number of fans in the world and the largest sort of attendance events. So what are their troubles?
Well, the troubles are, you know, it costs a lot of money to drive to these big, huge tracks, right? $4 a gallon gas. There's big concerns about, you know, all the fans driving and spending at the tracks. So what NASCAR is trying to do locally is to counteract, you know, discounting a lot of you know, services at the track, working with local hotels. But there's a major concern about, you know, the people just not having the economic strength to try to get to the track and spend all that money it takes just to get there.
So before we go, John, is it possible that this economic trend that you're describing could affect, not possible, the Yankees? I mean, they're going to move into a new stadium next year with ticket prices way, way above what they've been. It's possible that that may be like the sourest note in Yankee history. What do you think?
I think that that would be an unbelievably sour note. I don't think it's going to happen. I think that, you know, given the Yankees franchise, given that they're selling very long-term deals, I don't think that they're going to be hit particularly hard as other properties.
So they will be able to defend their price. What about baseball franchises elsewhere, the Brewers?
There's concern about ticket sales for next year. Yeah. I mean, here in Chicago, I'm in Chicago. Here,
well,
the
hey,
White
in
Sox.
Chicago, we can't talk about Chicago.
Yeah,
not today.
Sorry.
John Lombardo, thanks for joining us. Yeah. Staff writer for Sports Business Journal talking about economic woes in the sports industry.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, featuring stories of responsible acts that happen every day. Stories to read, share, and respond to, available at responsibilityproject.com. Because one responsible act can make an unforgettable difference.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Monday, October 6th. Richard Hake is with us, sitting in for Femi Oke, and he's got some headlines for us. Markets not doing so well.
Not so well. Actually, markets were down at the open as the country awaits results of the financial bailout bill all across the world, actually. Oil prices have also fallen to an eight-month low of less than $90 a barrel. And also, according to the Associated Press, according to an official, the Treasury Assistant Secretary will be tapped as the interim head of that $700 billion rescue plan. In other news, the Supreme Court opens a new term, and the first thing they're expected to do is formally deny hundreds of appeals. The first case to be argued deals with limits on lawsuits against tobacco companies. Three European scientists are sharing the 2008 Nobel Prize in Medicine. Two of them worked together to discover HIV, while the other found the virus that causes cervical cancer. Eli Lilly is acquiring ImClone for $6.5 billion. It's a defeat for Bristol Myers Squibb, which last month offered to buy most of the company for $60 a share. That bid attracted Eli Lilly's interest, and they won out by offering $70 a share. And finally, what would a collaboration between William Shakespeare and the Beatles sound like?
Thou art not so unkind as a man's ingratitude.
Musician Chris O'Neill imagines the working relationship between the great English artists in his new musical, A Bard Day's Night.
The Beatles go back in time and meet Shakespeare, and they basically work together, and he becomes very much the lyricist, I suppose, because he's on their level, basically, working-class hero and all.
O'Neill has set Shakespearean sonnets and extracts from the plays to songs of his own composition.
You know, there's some lyrics from Twelfth Night that remind me of Beatles tunes.
And this guy will also play the role of Paul McCartney.
There you go.
And he lives in Liverpool.
Oh, there you go. Liverpudlian.
Well, there's
as
some
well.
Symmetry for you.
Thanks, Richard.
Thanks very much.
You're
Richard.
Welcome.
As Richard was just reporting, markets are jittery this morning. The Dow is down just over 2%. The NASDAQ and S&P also down. And that comes on the heels of Asian markets down this morning. The Hong Kong's Hang Seng nearly 5%, and European markets down more than 5% today. Friday's approval by Congress of Bush's financial plan, many thought, would perhaps inject confidence in the U.S. and world markets. Matthew Bishop, chief business writer for The Economist, joins us now. Matthew, what's happening?
Well, as usual, we seem to be starting every week with a tremendous amount of fear in the markets. And this time, the Europeans, I think, have started, and the Asians have started off the general panic by realizing that they have massive problems in their own banking system, just as America has a huge problem that maybe it's on its way to fixing in its own banking system. So what's been primarily an American story of financial meltdown is now going global.
I might add that you are also an author of the book Philanthrop
philanthrocapitalism, how the rich can save the world. I can't get it out because it doesn't seem like the rich are saving the world at the moment.
Well, you know, Warren Buffett came into the market twice in the last 10 days and bought big shares in Goldman Sachs and General Electric. And, I think he's going to emerge from this considerably richer, and he's already the richest man in the world and also the world's biggest philanthropist. So, you know, maybe there's a sign that actually, you know, we're in America, that there is this turning point, that when fear is greatest, that's also the greatest opportunity for people to come in to the market. I'm also intrigued that, you know, there's a battle going on between Citibank and Wells Fargo Bank at the moment, where the lawyers are in court suing over who has the right to buy Wachovia. Now, that's a real change in mindset. You've got two of the country's biggest banks actually willing to go to court to buy another troubled bank.
Well, and the backstory
feeling is that they probably see a bottom in the market.
Well, but it's also, there's a backstory there. I mean, it could be that Citicorp is looking for deposits as a source of capital because there's a lot that's still not known about Citicorp's balance sheets.
That's right. But I think, you know, you're in a world now where I think some of the smarter minds think that there's value to be had by moving into the market, which is usually the turning point when you see the smart money see an opportunity and be willing to even get lawyers involved. I think that is, you know, one of the sort of straws in the wind that we should look at.
Well, I don't want to pin you down on a bottom here, but explain why the dollar is doing better than the euro this morning. Who's buying dollars and who's selling euros?
Well, I think, oddly, given that America has been the source of all the world's financial problems, the dollar is still the world's reserve currency, and that whenever you get fear in the market, people rush to what they think is the safe haven. And I guess America has been able to pass this bailout package. It has been able to find $700 billion. And so, you know, there is a belief out in the rest of the world that the U.S. is not going to go bust, that it has the capacity to address these problems. And so people are buying dollars.
Question for you, Matthew. There was this sense that perhaps Congress putting together a deal and President Bush signing it, that there would be this notion of, okay, the ship is starting to steady, let's move forward. But you just noted that some of the problems in Europe really don't have a whole lot to do with our problems here in the U.S.
Well, I think the problem now is that we've gone from worrying about a financial crisis to worrying about a global recession. I think people had hoped that once America had sorted out its financial system problem, that the rest of the world economy would still be in good shape. And I think they've now realized that, unfortunately, America's just taken that bit too long to solve its financial system problem. And in the meantime, the rest of the world economy has started to slow down quite dramatically, which obviously means that everyone's profits are going to be down, so shares are worth less.
Matthew, I have a dumb question. Is that permitted?
Certainly.
All right. In this case, the Treasury has announced this morning that they're going to go to the market and sell T-bills to finance the $700 billion or whatever the number is rescue plan. All right. Why, if I'm a Chinese investor, am I suddenly like thrilled to note that the Americans are going to borrow the money to pay for their own rescue?
It's not a dumb question at all, of course. But, it's I think the Chinese and indeed the Arabs, anyone that has a lot of cash, they understand that the American economy is still the biggest economy in the world, and that if they're going to grow, whether it be selling oil or whether it be selling exports, they need the American economy to be strong and to get back on its feet as quickly as possible, and they want to invest in it. And I think they have been investing in it over the last year or so while everyone else has been getting nervous. They've continued to step up to the plate and be willing to back the American economy, which I think in the long run is very, very good news for America.
Which brings me to what happens next. Obviously, all eyes are on not only the market here in the U.S., but globally speaking, what needs to happen on the part of U.S. leadership, or does that leadership come from someplace else to bring some sense of direction for these markets?
Well, I think the next question is going to be, will this bailout plan actually work? And I guess over the next couple of weeks, we're going to see what they're able to do and how quickly they're able to do it, because what the banking system and the whole financial system desperately needs at the moment is to get back to lending to people who have the need for cash. And last week it virtually came to a halt. So hopefully it's going to get moving again fast. But we don't know yet because it's all such a mystery as to what exactly is going to happen.
A mystery.
Well, a mystery.
Matthew, what do you watch to try to figure out if commercial paper is becoming more liquid and coming back?
Well, I think you're seeing some of the big companies are able to to have a slightly easier time in the markets. But I think we'll see over the next week, you know, the people who have been shut out of things like the car loan market or the mortgage market or some of the other big financial providers will start to tell you that they're more able to lend. But it's going to be a few days at least until we know what exactly the government, the Treasury, is doing with this huge pile of money that is voted.
Matthew Bishop, author of Philanthrocapitalism, How the Rich Can Save the World, and chief business writer for The Economist. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
Well, we'll wait and see, won't we?
Philanthrocapitalism, you did that very, very well. 283.
Thank you so much.
283 points down is the Dow Jones Industrial Average. We are always on at The Takeaway, and Election Day is a little more than 4 weeks away. We've got you covered. Complete coverage on our election website, vote2008.thetakeaway.org.
And this morning we're following the campaigns and the time that they have left, 4 weeks, the voters in another part of America's patchwork, the moneyed burbs, and the passage of the $700 billion bailout, or rescue plan, however you want to name it.
The voters are moving in the moneyed suburb there. Sarah Palin says Obama's palling around with terrorists. Obama supporters are talking about McCain and the Keating Five. That's five senators John McCain accused of corruption in the savings and loan crisis in the 1980s. Is this fair play?
No blood, no foul, right? So I'm cool with that.
He's a mercenary voter. What do you think? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
Here's your takeaway today.
People, I think during the Depression, everybody went to the movies. And I guess during this downturn, to take your mind off what's happening to you, you do something that distracts you, and that's entertainment.
That's Lou Uchitel, the New York Times reporter, talking about one of the few recession-proof industries, entertainment, or so we think.
Special event on our website today. It's been 10 years since the brutal killing of Matthew Shepard, a gay University of Wyoming student. You can listen to our conversation with the editor-in-chief of The Advocate magazine, John Barrett, about what's happened since then. Go to thetakeaway.org.
I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Huckenberry. We'll be taking live questions on our website at 1 p.m. today. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.